Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to CKSL. And today we're going to be looking at the practice of Vipassana, or insight practice. And to begin, I'd like to start with a short meditation just to settle ourselves a little bit and set a good motivation for the day. So make yourselves nice and comfortable. So it's an act of loving kindness for yourself. Let go of any external distractions. And simply allow your awareness to descend into your body, becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Then bringing your awareness to the area of your face and soften and relax all the muscles in the face. Mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And then setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Wherever you most distinctly notice sensations associated with the breath. We all want to be happy, and we all want to be free of problems and suffering. And it often seems to us as if the source of our happiness and the source of our suffering is out there in the world. And as a result, one of the main methods we use to try to overcome suffering and to find happiness is that we try to manipulate the things around us. We try to attract people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our happiness. And we try to push away or avoid people, places, and things that seem to be the source of our suffering. But no matter how hard we try to do this, we still seem to find problems and suffering. And we're still chasing after that elusive happiness. And if we don't get the things we want, we often become very frustrated. And even if we do get the things we want, they never seem to fully satisfy us. And we simply end up craving for more. And we often end up with a lot of dissatisfaction when things don't live up to our expectations. So, what is the solution? According to Buddhism, the underlying source of our suffering and the underlying source of our happiness lies within our own mind. It's our mental afflictions, such as attachment and craving, anger and hatred and jealousy. It's these mental afflictions that are the real source of our suffering. And these mental afflictions are coming from our distorted view of reality. Our grasping onto an independent me and an independent objective world. And that by reducing and eliminating our mental afflictions, we can overcome suffering. And by overcoming this fundamental ignorance, misunderstanding the nature of reality, coming to realize emptiness, we can totally eliminate all mental afflictions and suffering and find genuine happiness. And not just genuine happiness for ourselves, but then have the ability to help those around us also to overcome suffering and find happiness. So understanding this, we can set the best possible motivation we can for our time together today in our discussion and practice of emptiness, our practice of Vipassana. and then release all appearances. And simply allow the mind to come to rest. Simply resting in awareness itself. Simply be aware of being aware. So we can bring the meditation to a close. So again, our topic for today is the Vipassana practice, or in Pali, Vipassana. So remember, this word Vipassana or Vipassana, the VI means higher or superior. Passana or Passana means to see. So Vipassana practice is higher seeing, seeing beyond. Often translated into English as special insight or simply insight. Meaning that this is insight practice or wisdom practice, trying to come to realize the nature of reality. Now, of course, in Vipassana practice, there are many different insights we can come to realize or develop or cultivate. And so we saw on Friday evening in this three vehicles chart here that at the Theravada level of practice, where the goal is nirvana, personal liberation from samsara, we saw that the Vipassana practice in these traditions primarily focuses on three types of insight called the three marks of existence here. We see in that last column that the first insight we're trying to cultivate or realize is this wisdom of impermanence, or in Pali, anicca, trying to come to realize that things are changing moment by moment. And as I mentioned previously, of course, I think all of us have an intellectual understanding and an intellectual belief in impermanence because science has proven it and we accept that. So we all intellectually accept that things are changing moment by moment. But of course, our intellectual understanding of that fact is not really helping us much in our life at all because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habits are telling us that things are actually quite stable. Our instinctive habit is to see that this glass here is more or less the same glass that was here yesterday, it'll be the same glass here tomorrow. So we behave as if things are quite stable and static, which of course is a distorted perspective of reality because nothing is stable or static. Everything's changing momentarily, but we base our behavior on that instinctive sense that things are quite stable and static. And that's why we end up with mental afflictions and suffering. So what we need to do, of course, in terms of impermanence and all the other insights is not just leave it as some intellectual understanding. We need to bring that into experience through meditation. We need to internalize that intellectual understanding. We need to come to realize directly that things are changing moment by moment. And by doing that, then we are going to change our instinctive habits, our instinctive perspective of things. And then instinctively, we'll start to see things as actually changing moment by moment. And thereby, because of that, you will find that your mental afflictions such as attachment and aversion will dramatically decrease and thereby decrease suffering as well. So this is the first insight we are trying to cultivate within the Theravada tradition. The second one was this one about suffering or dukkha, to come to realize the unsatisfactory nature of our existence. And of course, the reason this insight is important is if we don't realize this, we're going to continually look for happiness out there, hoping that something out there will really satisfy us and bring us some genuine happiness. But by coming to realize dukkha or suffering, one of the implications of that is that we'll come to really directly realize there's nothing out there that's going to fully satisfy us. So it's a waste of time looking out there for genuine happiness or stable, lasting happiness. And at a deeper level, through realizing dukkha, we'll come to realize that actually the source of our suffering and happiness is within our own mind. And then we'll strive to overcome these mental afflictions and ignorance in our mind, and then we can strive for genuine happiness. A genuine happiness of having eliminated that cause of suffering, the ignorance and mental afflictions. And thereby, we'll strive for that goal of nirvana. And how we achieve that is through the third insight here, this wisdom of no self or anatman. Because here in the Theravada, the ignorance that we are suffering from, that is the root of samsara, is a distorted view of ourself as a person. We overinflate the sense of me. We grasp on to what's called self. We believe that this me that's here is more solid and substantial than it really is. And we grasp onto this self. And then we relate to things on that basis. And that's why we have attachment, aversion, mental afflictions, suffering. So if we come to realize there is no such self, then we can eliminate all mental afflictions, all suffering, and achieve the goal of nirvana. So remember, this grasping itself here is that what is actually here is simply a body and a mind. But instinctively and intellectually, we can sort of appreciate that, I think, that there is a body and a mind here. That's it. Nothing more than that. But instinctively, we have a sense that there's something more than that. There's this third thing. There's this me, this self, that is the owner of this body and mind. And this me, this self, seems to stand apart from the body and the mind. It seems to be something a little bit more than just the body and the mind. That's our instinctive sense of me. That's a false sense of me called self, grasping onto self. So by coming to realize there's no such self, we can achieve nirvana. So this is the Vipassana practice at the level of Theravada. These are the three main insights we are trying to cultivate. Today, I would like to focus on the Vipassana practice within the Mahayana tradition. So within the Mahayana tradition, we see in this chart here that the Vipassana practice is this wisdom of emptiness, or in Sanskrit, shunyata. Because in the Mahayana tradition, it's accepted that there is a deeper level of ignorance than this merely this self-grasping. That yes, there is this false sense of me grasping to self, but there's a deeper level of ignorance that we need to eliminate if we want to achieve enlightenment. And that deeper level of ignorance is this false grasping, believing that there is an independent me and an independent objective world. Because that's how things appear to us. There really does appear to be an independent objective world there and an independent subjective me here. And so that is our instinctive perspective, and we simply grasp onto that. We never question these appearances. But here in the Mahayana, perspective is false. This is the fundamental ignorance that's the root of samsara. So we need to come to realize that there is, in fact, no independent me, no independent objective world. That is what emptiness means. Emptiness means nothing exists independently. Everything's empty of independent existence. And if we can come to realize this, then we can eliminate deepest level of ignorance, all mental afflictions, all suffering, and
with a bodhicitta motivation, we can achieve the goal of enlightenment. So that's what I want to focus on today, is what is this emptiness? What is this ignorance that we're suffering from? How is this ignorance leading to our mental afflictions and suffering? And how do we go about eliminating this ignorance and thereby achieving the goal of enlightenment? So this is what I want to focus on today. Before I begin, one piece of advice, and that is this topic of emptiness or shunyata is not easy to understand. It's a very subtle topic, very difficult to understand. So this is a topic that you will need to hear about, read about, think about, meditate about many, many, many times to gain a good understanding of this concept. So if you have sort of a little bit of an expectation that you'll have a reasonable understanding of emptiness at the end of today, I think you're just setting yourself up for a lot of unnecessary frustration and disappointment. So today then, whatever you can pick up from what we discuss and meditate on is good. What you don't understand, then next time you hear about it and read about it, you may understand a little bit more. Okay. And to begin this discussion, I'd like to first read again a little bit from Alan Wallace, from a book he wrote many years ago called Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up, where he sort of introduces this idea. So I'd like to read from that before we begin our discussions. And he says the following. Many of us believe that we directly perceive objective physical phenomena with our five physical senses, that the mental images we perceive via our senses are accurate representations of the objects we perceive. However, neurologist Antonio Damasio refutes this assumption, which is commonly called naive realism. So now he's quoting the neurologist who says the following. When you and I look at an object outside ourselves, we form comparable images in our respective brains. We know this well because you and I can describe the object in very similar ways, down to fine detail. But that does not mean that the image we see is the copy of whatever the object outside is like. Whatever it is like in absolute terms, we do not know. Now back to Alan Wallace, who says, in light of this neuroscientific view, with our five senses, we directly perceive images generated in the brain. But these are not truly representations of anything existing independently of the brain. These sensory impressions of colours, sounds, smells, and so on are no more tangible than thoughts or dreams. While we seem to experience colours and so on as they exist in the objective world, independent of our senses, this is an illusion, very much like a dream. Having determined that the reality we perceive depends on our sense faculties, what then really does exist outside our senses? When we close this book and leave the room, shutting the door behind us, what remains? It is an ancient question that has been asked since the time of the Greeks. What exists behind appearances? What really exists out there? This brings up a familiar problem. What happens when a tree falls and nobody is in the forest to watch it or hear it? Most people agree something happened. The tree trunk is on the ground, there is a big dent, things start to rot, and ants and termites live in the fallen trunk. But what happened? Western scientists have traditionally responded to this question by trying to find primary or intrinsic qualities of the falling tree that can be measured. Mass is one of those, the idea being that the tree has a quantifiable amount of stuff to it. Speed is another quality that does not seem to depend on anyone's perception. Briefly considering the history of Western scientific thinking on this point may be a useful digression that may help us better understand the nature of emptiness. Also, by examining our cultural assumptions about the nature of reality, we can better understand and penetrate those assumptions, and by so doing, come to appreciate the Buddhist view. Since Galileo took his telescope and turned it on Jupiter, scientific thought has increasingly depended on the power of mechanical instruments. We get the sense, and it is widely promoted by science, that by using mechanical instruments and mathematics, we stop being subjective and instead become objective. Everyone knows the senses can be misleading, it is said, so let us dispense with the senses. They are giving us only appearances anyway, and we're trying to penetrate through those. The idea of objective measurement came to be strongly emphasized during the time of Galileo, and by the end of the 19th century, scientists felt the objective science of physics was virtually complete. The physics of the time was assumed, with very few exceptions, to be an absolute representation of what was really out there. At the beginning of the 20th century, this view began to break down. Scientists started to understand more clearly that their instruments of measurement were themselves contributing to the data they were detecting. But the real revolution came with the development of quantum physics, which investigates the very smallest components of physical reality. It is here that the participatory nature of measurement and experimentation becomes most obvious. In quantum mechanics, attributes of mass, speed, shape, and location vanish as purely objective entities. All of them can only be seen in relationship to the methods of measurement. As the renowned physicist Werner Heisenberg said, "What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning." As scientists looked still deeper, they also started questioning the objectivity of the analytical tools they use. Mathematics, for instance, is one more human creation. Euclidean geometry is only one of a theoretically infinite number of geometries that can be used, and the same goes for algebra and for various logic systems. The subjective element seems to be inescapable on all fronts. In no facet of science, whether we are dealing with astronomy, physics, or medicine, do we even get one bit of information about any reality existing independently of our modes of questioning. All our sensory experience consists of experiences that are contingent upon our sense faculties. Even by reducing everything to the subatomic level of electrons, quarks, and so forth, we are still left with nothing but appearances. What is inescapable is that all that we know of the world, theoretically and empirically, consists of appearances to the mind. We have access to nothing else. Understanding this, the concept of reification becomes universally applicable. In the same way that when we look out on the world and view perceived objects as if they existed inherently in objective space, so too do we view things like electrons and sound waves as if they existed independently of our conceptions of them. Perceived objects exist in relation to the conceptual schemata within which they are understood. We reify an object by removing it from its context, by ignoring the subjective influences of perception and conception. Okay. So let's begin our discussions then. So here, what we're talking about is that things appear to exist independently. There appears to be an independent me here and an independent objective world out there. So we are grasping onto the fact or believing, grasping onto a belief in things existing independently. So we're talking about independent existence. Now in the texts, there are a number of terms used to describe this.
probably the most common term that you will see in the texts is a term inherent existence. And inherent existence has the sort of the idea that things are self-existent. They have their own unique nature of being that thing. So they exist within themselves. This is the meaning of inherent existence. Another term that's commonly used is things existing from its own side. Something existing from its own side has the idea that it does not require an observer for it to exist. It simply exists from its own side, meaning that things are already existing there from their own side, just waiting for us to experience them. And another term that's commonly used in the texts is true existence. Now, the word true generally in English, of course, means something is true if it's not deceiving us. So here, of course, things appear to exist independent of us. If that's actually how they really exist, they would be true. Meaning the way in which things appear and the way in which they actually exist match. So that's what true existence means. True existence means things existing in the same way in which they appear. So these are probably the three most common terms that you will see in the text describing independent existence. So of course they all mean the same thing, but they're talking about the same thing from a slightly different perspective. So these are the various terms that, there are other terms as well sometimes used, but these are probably the three most common terms used to describe independent existence. And so, of course, this is how things appear to us. In fact, everything has always appeared to us in this way. So we've never experienced things in any other way. So there's no reason for us to question these appearances. So we simply automatically accept these appearances. You know, that things, there appears to be an independent me, an independent objective world. That's how everything always appears to us. We simply accept that and we believe in it. We grasp onto that. Independent me, independent world. But what here in the Mahayana, in the Vipassana practice, what they're saying is that if we investigate these appearances, will come to actually realize that things are not existing as they appear. And so then what we have is coming to understand that nothing exists independently. And another way of saying that is that things are empty of inherent existence. That's usually how it's phrased. So, of course, empty of inherent existence means not inherently existent, not independently existent. And what this view is saying is that if we come to investigate, we'll come to realize that things are not independently existent because they are dependently existent. And the term for that is dependent arising. Here this word arising means coming into existence. So things come into existence dependently. So this is what we will come to realize here, is that things really are not independently existent because they are dependently existent. So this term here, empty of inherent existence, is emptiness.
or in Sanskrit, shunyata. So emptiness, of course, is not saying nothing really exists. Emptiness is saying that things are empty of independent existence. They're not independently existent, because they are, in fact, dependently existent. So we need to remember that emptiness does not mean non-existence. It just means that things are empty of independent existence. They lack independent existence. They're not independently existent. So to understand what we mean by that really, what we can do is, of course, look at this word dependent arising. If we can appreciate how things are in fact dependently existent, then that will help us to understand how they're not independently existent. So that's what I'd like to look at now. Before I do that, does anyone have any questions of anything so far?
When you gave the introduction,
you
were talking about behavior.
I was talking about what, sorry?
Of behavior.
Behavior, yeah.
Which is instinctive behavior.
Well, our behavior is based on our instinctive habits. That's right. And that conditioning equals instinctive habit.
What does that mean? Because instinctive is when you're doing something which, like the argument is that when a man goes, or an uncle or whatever, they are acting in an instinctive manner.
Correct.
While we have some amount of conditioning or socialization.
Correct.
Which goes into our upbringing or, right from babyhood.
Yeah. Right. So these habits in Buddhism, we can talk about what's called innate, which are ones that come through birth, and then there are intellectually acquired ones as well. So because of our cognitive ability, then as a human, then through conditioning, social or whatever, then we can form those instinctive habits through conditioning as well, not just from birth. Whereas a lot of animals with less cognitive ability have a very limited ability to do that. But we as humans, our instinctive habits are a mix of these two, the ones that come through birth and the ones through conditioning.
So therefore, you cannot just say instinctive. I have a problem with that.
Oh, okay, then pick another word. It's okay. Doesn't matter. What I'm just suggesting is that our behaviour is not coming through thinking about things in the moment. It comes sort of, well, if you don't want to use the word instinctive, through conditioning or whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm just suggesting it's not like when we behave, it's not
intellectually analyzable.
Exactly. That's what I want to say. That's why intellectual understanding, changing our intellectual understanding, merely that is not going to change our behavior dramatically. Oh, this is the topic coming. I mean,
So, but isn't that maybe we could interpret this as an emotional reaction?
Sure. And not everything's an emotional reaction, but we tend to react. We tend to be stimulus reaction machines. Yeah. So, the word inherent existence here means that things are self-existent, they have their own unique nature. Like, it seems like this has, it's in there, there's this unique nature for it to be a glass. It seems to be self-existent as a glass, that has a unique nature of being glass, that is completely independent of us. That's what inherent means. It means really just having its own unique intrinsic nature of being that thing. Sure.
So how come it itself has any kind of quality?
Because we attribute qualities to it. See, that's the thing. What we're trying to understand here is that qualities seem to be in the object, don't they? But don't we attribute qualities to objects? Like you said. But Is that how we behave? Do we behave as if we are attributing qualities to things, or do we behave as if the qualities are there already? Exactly. That's the problem. That's this. That's why we have mental afflictions and suffering. For example, when we see something and we have a pleasant experience, don't we automatically assume there's some attractive quality there? There's some beauty in the object, don't we? Is there beauty in the object? Is there beauty in any object itself? If a particular object was inherently beautiful in the object, wouldn't that mean that everyone who saw it would have to see it as beautiful? Wouldn't they? Unless, of course, their vision's impaired, but assuming they can see clearly, if the beauty is in the object, that would mean everyone would have to see it as beautiful. And there's no thing in the universe where everyone would see it as beautiful or ugly or whatever. So correct. So what we need to correctly understand here, which I'm coming into, is if we see a flower and we have a pleasant experience and we see it as beautiful, we, based on our pleasant experience, are attributing the quality of beauty to that object. Makes sense. Is that how we behave? No. We behave as if the beauty is in the flower. Therefore, there's beauty there. That flower is causing my pleasant experience. I want that flower. Give me that flower. Attachment. Whereas if we could correctly understand that we are attributing the quality of beauty to the flower, does that mean we won't enjoy the flower? No, it means we'll enjoy it more. We won't have the craving and clinging to it. We'll actually just be present with it and enjoy it. That's the implication of realizing this. Because often people, when we come to investigate and realize emptiness, people feel, oh, because things are empty, there's nothing really there. So there's no beauty. So therefore, if we sort of realize emptiness, everything will become bland and boring. Actually, it's the exact opposite. Exact opposite. By realizing emptiness, we'll realize that beauty is a dependent phenomenon, and we will appreciate the beauty much more. Because now we believe the beauty is there, and that actually is the source of my happiness. I want that thing, you know. If I don't get it, I'm going to be upset. And so we actually destroy our appreciation of beauty through our agitation, through our craving and clinging and wanting it. Whereas if we can get rid of all that by realizing this, we would actually enjoy the beauty much more. And as I think mentioned on maybe yesterday or on Friday evening, our attachment is always looking for bigger, better, different. Bigger, better, different. You know, always wants more, 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 because we're never satisfied. Which means, you know, maybe the first time we see a particular flower, we go, wow, that's really nice. But if we've got them growing in our garden and we see them day after day after day, after a while they'll become boring, won't they? Does that mean they're becoming less attractive? No, it's because our attachment's going, well, no, that's not bigger, better, different. That's the same stuff. I want something different and bigger and better. So actually, our attachment, our distorted view, actually then causes us to lose, miss out on pleasurable behaviour, on pleasurable experiences, because our attachment says, no, that's not beautiful anymore. I want something different. So what you'll find is that when you come to realise things are in fact dependent, you will continue to enjoy beautiful things, and you'll enjoy a lot of other things that now you find very boring. That's my experience and the experience of many people. But anyway, this is coming. Yeah.
You said emptiness is no independent self, no independent world.
Yeah, no independent everything, meaning everything.
Right. So I'm just trying to relate that to the no self.
Right.
Is that no independent self or
yes.
No self?
Well, So self is in the context of Vipassana practice. So, I mean, in general, in Buddhism, we can talk about self and others. That just means me versus others. So, we're not talking about that.
Okay.
Here, in the context of Vipassana, self means overinflated sense of me. And we can overinflate the sense of me in a number of levels. So they're all false, of course. So the first way in which we can
False.
So at the time of the Buddha, there are a number of other traditions around, of course, and a lot of these traditions were talking about life after life and some sort of liberation. And a lot of them, I mean, of course, any tradition that talks about something after this life has to say what goes from life to life and what achieves liberation. And a lot of these traditions were saying it's the self that does that. And a lot of these traditions were saying this self had certain qualities. And they often were saying that this self was something unchanging, not changing from moment to moment, unitary, meaning it's a single thing with no parts, and it was completely independent of everything else. So this was one notion of self that was probably still existing today, but certainly at the time of the Buddha, that the Buddha refuted. He's saying that we do not exist in this way. This is a grossly overinflated sense of me that we is false, we get rid of. And even according to Buddhism, we don't instinctively have this false sense of me. This would only be a false sense of me that you could come through some wrong intellectual thinking. But there's another one which I talked about briefly in the context of Theravada. And that is this idea of a self that is self-sufficient, substantially existent. What this means, and this false sense of me we have instinctively. Because, you know, instinctively we have this sense that there's somehow, there's a me here somewhere, yeah? And this me here is something more than the body and the mind. And instinctively, it doesn't seem to depend on the body and the mind to exist. Intellectually, of course, we can understand that's not possible. But instinctively, you know, we have it in our language. You know, we say, I have a body. I have a mind. Where is this me that has a body and a mind, that stands apart from the body and the mind, that has a body and has a mind? We say that, don't we? Where is that me? Can there be a me that stands apart from the body and the mind, that owns or has a body and a mind? This is what self-sufficient, substantial existence means. That sense of me. That we have instinctively. That's the one that I talked about in the Theravada, no self. So this one we don't really need to worry about because it's only something that you come up through some wrong intellectual thinking. This one we instinctively have. So in the Theravada, when we talk about realizing no self to achieve nirvana, this is the one we need to realize, that there's no me like this. There's no me that stands apart from the body and the mind in this sort of self-sufficient, substantial way. But still here, even though they realize there's no such me, no such self rather, there's still a body and a mind. And that body and mind exists independently. Whereas Mahayana, they go, no, you have to go more. There's the self that is independent or inherently existent. So you can eliminate this and still be grasping onto this, because this is more subtle. So this is what we're talking about here.
So no independent self includes no self.
Yeah, I mean these are all false ways of inflating the sense of me. So this is a very subtle level of inflation. This is more coarse, and that's the most coarse. So this, of course, is very easy to get rid of. In fact, a lot of us don't even have it because it's only something through some wrong intellectual thinking. This we instinctively have, and according to Theravada, if we get rid of this false sense of me, we can achieve nirvana. But in the Mahayana, they would disagree. They say, if you get rid of this false sense of me, yes, that would be fantastic. A lot of mental afflictions and stuff would dramatically reduce, your life would dramatically improve, much less suffering. But still, there's still a more subtle level of grasping going on, even if we get rid of that, and that's this. This is the most subtle level of grasping onto self, that Mahayana says we have to get rid of this if we really want to achieve nirvana and enlightenment. And so this is what we are talking about today here. Yeah. So in the Theravada, the me does exist from its own side, does inherently exist. In the Theravada, this cup exists inherently. There is no problem with the world as we see it. There is an objective world. No problem. There is a subjective me. The problem is this. This is more than that. That's on top of that. If we get rid of that, we can achieve nirvana. But Mahayana says, well, that's not enough. That's a good start. With that, you'll really improve your life dramatically. But there's a deeper level of ignorance than this, and that's this. And that's what we're trying to eliminate. This is what emptiness is about. No inherent existence.
The Theravada tradition doesn't acknowledge this?
This is a very difficult point. I think generally the way it's presented, no. But even great Mahayana teachers such as Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti, great Indian masters, go to great lengths to quote sutras within the Theravada tradition and go, look, the Buddha taught it there, but it's not so obvious. Because this idea of in emptiness is very subtle, very difficult to understand, and if you can't really understand it, there's a great danger of flipping to the other extreme of nihilism. And so this, therefore, the Buddha didn't teach this idea of emptiness to everyone, because most people would listen to this and they go, oh, Buddha's saying nothing exists. That's not a very good place to be, because if we are believing in nihilism, then we can easily say, well, if nothing really exists, nothing really matters, I can just do whatever I want. So, therefore, this idea of emptiness was not really that widely taught. Well, to give the full answer, we have to talk more about this, which is coming, but I can talk a little bit more about this. Like, you know, we say, I have a body, I have a mind. And in that way of saying that, we have the sense that there is a me that has a body. So, in the way of saying that, it feels like this me is not the same as the body. True? Because if the me and the body are the same, it would be nonsensical to say, I have a body. You couldn't. It would be like saying the body has a body. I mean, this just doesn't make sense. So, and we say, I have a body, because instinctively we have a sense that there is a me that's something a little bit different than the body. That's why we can say that, because that's what our instinctive sense. So, we feel that because the sense of me is always based on some aspect of the body and the mind, we have a sense that the me is somewhere here. You know, we never have a sense that the me is over there, do we? It's always somewhere here, mixed in, yet it seems to be something a little bit more than the body and the mind. There seems to be this me here And sometimes this is called the idea of the master or controller. Because we have a sense that there's a me here that's trying to run the show. There's a me here that's trying to, you know, fix up the mind and work with the body. And we instinctively have a sense that there's this third thing. There's a body, there's a mind, and then there's a me. That's this idea. But if we look here, what's here? Yes, there's a body. There's a mind. If the me is more than the body and the mind, then we should be able to take away the body and the mind and be left with the me, shouldn't we? Logically speaking. True? If there is a me that's distinct from the body and the mind, we have to be able to take away the body and the mind and be left with the me. If we take away this body and mind, is there anything left over? No. And so that's the sort of reasoning we can use to realise there's no such self. That's what we're going to do actually in the next session. We're going to meditate in that way and see really is there such a me, a self here or not. So that's the idea of this self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Then, of course, we can say there's no such self, but of course there is a body and a mind. But Mahayana's saying that there is no inherently existent body or mind or inherently existent world. So we have to go to the next level, because here, there, things do exist as they appear. There is a body, an objective body, there is an objective mind, there is an objective world, no problem. The problem is, on top of that objective body, mind and world, we think there's another thing. There's this substantial me that we need to get rid of. And then, so that's a good start, but then Mahayana's saying, well, hang on, we've got more work to do, because there is no objective body, mind or world. That things are deceptive. Things do not exist as they appear. So that's what we're looking at now. Right. So, of course, if we're doing the observing the mind meditation as a shamatha practice, that question is of no interest. It's the wrong time to entertain that question. So, if we're doing shamatha practice and we're observing the mind, then the thought, who is this observer, is an obstacle. We need to let it go. Or just watch it, you know. That question, of course, is a valid question in vipassana practice. So in vipassana practice, these are the sorts of questions we ask and investigate in vipassana practice. So again, conventionally we can say there is an observer or witness. But of course the question you're asking is, who or how does this observer or witness exist? Because it seems like there is this independent observer. But if we investigate through this sort of questioning, we'll come to realise there is no independent observer, but there is a dependent observer, a dependent witness. But what that means, we're going to look at now in the next session.
When you mean things being dependent arising, you mean they depend on many parts.
We're going to talk about that. There's three ways that things are dependent arisings, and that's the next topic. So details coming.
The first one is what in other traditions is called the soul, and the second one is what is called the ego.
Oof. I think it'd be very dangerous to put those labels in that way. One is that, of course, soul, I think, even within simply Christianity, can mean many different things. I mean, I don't think Christians in general are uniform in their understanding of what the word soul means. I think there are many disparate views about the word soul, as in psychology, the word ego. So I think to throw in and say this is the soul and this is the ego is just going to create confusion. So I don't want to go there. Of course, a valid question is, does Buddhism believe in ego or soul? But then to answer that question, you have to say, what's your definition of the word soul? And then based on your individual definition of that word, then we can answer yes or no. If your understanding of soul is that the soul is like this, has these qualities, then Buddhism would say no such soul. If your definition of ego is this, ego does not exist. So it completely depends on your concept of what those words mean. So that's why I don't like to throw those in, because, you know, if I say something about the ego, in this room there's probably at least half a dozen different ideas about what ego is, and then there's just mass confusion. You know? So better to stay with very clearly defined terms within Buddhism. And then if you have your own understanding of the word ego or soul, then you can try and match that to these. I think that's a much better approach. According to Buddhism, me exists, self does not exist.
Sorry?
In Buddhism, me exists, person exists, self does not exist.
So
never has existed.
Body, mind, complex is the me.
Sorry?
Body, mind, complex is the me.
No.
Then what is me?
That's what we're going to look at in the session after lunch. To answer that, I have to give a lot of background information. A brief answer is that what this view is saying is that nothing is findable, but it exists. But again, I have to talk about this and other things to really answer this question, so we're slowly moving up to that by after lunch session. Okay, just a couple more minutes, then we'll take a morning tea break. So the question here was about dependence. How are things dependent? What do we mean by things being dependent? So by understanding how things come into existence dependently, that's going to help us to understand emptiness. The first way in which things are dependent is that they exist depending on causes and conditions. For example, this laptop here exists through causes and conditions. One of the first conditions necessary was someone needed to design this thing. Then, of course, all the raw materials needed to be gathered, refined. All the various components needed to be manufactured, all those components needed to be assembled, and then all the people and factories and everything else involved in the whole process is required. Without all of those causes and conditions, there would be no laptop here. So this, I think, is fairly easy to understand. Things also exist, of course, depending on their parts. This laptop exists depending on the parts. Without the casing, the screen, the electronic components, the keyboard, without all of these various parts, there would be no laptop. So again, I think this is fairly easy to appreciate. But what we're saying here is that the reasoning of dependent arising should be overturning the idea that things are independently existent because they're mutually exclusive. But I think we are all happy to accept that this laptop exists depending on causes and conditions, and it exists depending on its parts. I think we're all happy to accept that. But at the same time, I think most of us are happy to accept that when we walk in the door, there's already a laptop sitting here on the table. Is that true? That should be not possible. Because this reasoning of dependent arising should be overturning the idea that there's an independent existent laptop. doesn't seem to do it, does it? Why? The reason is because we only understand these two ideas at a very superficial level. To understand these at the deepest level, we have to go to the third way in which things are dependent. And that is that things exist depending on imputation, labelling, conception, designation. These are all four words that mean the same thing. And so when we look at this, we go, oh, I think I know what that means. That means there's a thing here on the table which we're calling a laptop. Again, that's quite a superficial understanding of this idea. So how are we to understand that things are exist through imputation, labelling, conception and designation? How are we to understand it at a deeper level? And I'll just briefly introduce that before we take a tea break. When we look out on the world, we just receive a mass of sense data, particularly visual data. That's our strongest sense. And of course, we need to make sense out of all of this stuff that we receive. Otherwise, we couldn't function in the world. So what we do when we receive all this mass of data is that we try to make meaning out of it. So what we do is, in fact, we draw lines around various collections of data and make that collection of data into a single object. So we break up all of this data into discrete objects by drawing these lines. We have to do that, otherwise it's just senseless data. But we need to do more than that, because we live in this world together with others. To be able to communicate, we have to give names to these things so we can communicate. So this third point here, that things are labelled, exist through imputation, labelling, conception, designation, is this process. Is the process of drawing a line and then giving a name on top of that. But already when we've drawn the line, we've done this. Giving the name is just a little bit extra to help us to communicate. How we divide up the world is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of what we see. For example, if we look over in this direction over here and we see all this data coming in, we may simply draw one line around the whole thing and say there's one wall cabinet there. Or we may draw, seven lines and say there's seven cupboards there. Or we may draw three lines and say there's three display cabinets there. Or we may draw probably about 25 or 30 lines and say there's 25 statues there. So how many things are there? We decide. We decide. It's not fixed. It's completely arbitrary depending on the meaning that we want to get out. For example, a very good one, and it may be more easy than that, is this. How many objects are here? How many? But remember, we believe in independent existence. If things exist independently, they exist independent of our conception. So it should be fixed how many objects are there. Because it shouldn't depend on us. But is there one object? Is there one star? Is there two triangles? Is there six triangles? Is there six triangles and a hexagon? Or is there 17 lines? How many objects are there? We decide. That's what this means. So what we see here is often the term that things are merely labeled. So this word merely is really refuting that there's nothing more than that process, that things are not existing from their own side. So we see this, you know, things are merely labeled. This word merely comes up a lot in this context. And that's what it really means here. Any question before we go for a morning tea break? Everyone's stunned. Yes.
Does in the Theravada tradition, is there an acknowledgement of a dependent self?
All Buddhist traditions accept that things are dependent. So in the Theravada, they would certainly accept those. And when they talk about the person, they also say the person's labelled on the body and the mind. But what they mean by that is not the same as what we're talking about here. That's why we tend to use the word merely labelled. That merely is refuting inherent existence. So in the Theravada, they would say that the person is labelled on the body and the mind.
So there is a dependence.
Yeah, of course. All of Buddhist schools accept dependency. All of them.
So then why this label no self?
Like I said here, in the lower philosophical systems, they would accept that this laptop exists depending on course and conditions and paths. Yet, at the same time, they would accept that the laptop inherently exists. They see no contradiction in that. Whereas here, what we're saying is that that's a big contradiction.
Is it more like, you know, the whole is more than the sum of the parts? Like, for example, the laptop does exist. It's just more than the sum of the parts.
No, it's not. So that's the next point, which I'm going to bring in after the tea break, is we believe that the whole is the sum of the parts, instinctively. This view is saying the whole is not the sum of the parts, the whole is not more than the sum of the parts, the whole is not less than the sum of the parts.
That would be just another point of view.
What this view says is that the whole depends on the parts.
That is obvious. But
what do we mean by that?
Yeah, but there is also, for example, the laptop as a distinct, you know, object is much more than all the parts put together, the process which went into, you know,
depends what you mean by more. I mean, by giving it a concept of laptop, we create functionality. Is that what you mean by more?
Yes. I mean,
then we create the more. There's not more there.
I mean, what I'm alluding to is it has certain characteristics which are inherent.
No. This view says no. No, nothing has any inherent characteristic. Nothing. But does that mean there's no characteristics? No. See, this is the tricky point. This is the tricky point, is that it instinctively, when we look at objects, they seem to have characteristics in them, don't they? Don't they? Without us doing anything. But this is an illusion. We create characteristics. Attributes. I mean, you know, we see this and we see that this is, you know, a very high piece of equipment that can do a lot of things. But it seems like that qualities or characteristics are in the object. But if they were in the object, then a caveman would have to see that. A caveman would not see that. They'd just see some sort of square object that maybe they could throw at an animal or something, wouldn't they? So do these qualities exist for a caveman? No. But if they were in the object, they should. Unless he was blind. So this is the thing we need to sort of think about. Anyway, it's time for a tea break. So let's have a tea break and come back. So 20-minute tea break, come back at 11:45. And there's more. I want to talk in the after break about this in more detail. Try and get a better understanding of that.